He doesn't get the ball, the goalkeeper. It's as simple as that. Gets the Wolves player. I mean, oh. The check is complete.
Well, Gary O'Neill is fuming, I think, down there.
Hello and welcome to the Late Kickoff Football Podcast. There were howls of appeal at Old Trafford, but VAR said, "Ooh, nah, nah," as Wolves are denied a point. Poch avoids disaster as Disasi cancels out Louise at the bridge, but Salah sulks as the Egyptian exited early. The Ange Revolution avoids a caning, and Brentford look frankly the same without Ivan Toney. A minging injury for Tyrone is the catalyst for a villainous defeat for Unai in Tyneside, and Tonali is already the talk of the Toon Army. We're back for another fantastic season of Premier League football, and I'm delighted to be joined with a full cohort with Mike Wood. Mike, how you doing?
Yes, and do well, Jamie. How about yourself?
Absolutely fantastic, mate. Delighted to have got that out in the first take. And Sheila, yourself?
Yep. Also good. Hats off to you for doing that all in one go.
Fantastic, mate. That's the sort of support I need. loads of talking points for us to cover. We'll start with a look at Ref Watch and some of the big changes that I think we've seen take hold this weekend in the Premier League, the discussions that have built around it. We'll look at changes to the coverage of football, a new look TNT, a new look Soccer Saturday. Are we entering a new dawn of footballing coverage on the telly? And then we'll get into the games, covering the main talking points and the transfers in relation to the teams we're discussing as we go. And we'll probably cover a few of those in-game decisions at that point as well. But yeah, let's start with the main changes. So there's obviously been no changes to the laws of the game specifically. Well, I say obviously, maybe some people don't know that, but there hasn't been. But what we are seeing is a return to World Cup levels of added time. We're seeing a change in yellow cards for delaying the restart of play, the time-wasting yellow cards. We're seeing yellow cards for waving the imaginary yellow and arguably just seeing a general increase in yellow cards actually as well, which was something only last season or the season before we were being told they were moving away from. Probably take them one at a time. The main one that's been discussed is the significant amounts of added time in the games. There was 10 minutes played at Old Trafford last night. There was 11 minutes in the first half of Tottenham against Brentford. Mike, in some ways we've seen it already because we had the World Cup, but it's new in a Premier League context, and it's already causing a lot of debate. It's causing interesting situations in games, difficult for players and managers. But Howard Webb said it's here to stay. What do you make of all?
I think Ferran's tweet was interesting. The part about the overworkload of players. We've seen like an extensive pre-season for the first time in a while, and then we've seen muscle injuries come from that. If you're adding another 5 minutes onto the end of the game, it doesn't sound like much at the time, but obviously across the course of potentially 50, 60 games, you're talking about another 300 minutes onto the body. So I think it's, I don't mind where it's coming from, but at the point of where it's, where a player's going to break down more and more, then are we losing something from the game? And I think that's really the issue I have with it, more so that you're just adding more minutes into players' bodies. You're not necessarily adding to the spectacle in some ways. You're perhaps detracting from it because these athletes can only go so far for so long before you see them break down.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? Because the average game last season was 99 minutes. And I see that the average from the weekend there was 104 minutes. So, which seems strange because obviously last season we weren't seeing anything like the sort of 10 at Old Trafford or the 11 at Brentford, but perhaps that'll get longer. Sheila, the idea is it's born from wanting more minutes of actual football being played. But, you know, is there equally an argument that the extra minutes that we're getting at the end of the first half, at the end of full time, you know, aren't that brilliant anyway? You know, I think Thomas Frank said his players they hadn't really planned for it. His players didn't know what to do with 11 minutes at the end of the first half, and actually the attempts to avoid time wasting should be where the focus is, as opposed to simply just adding on swathes of time.
Yeah, 100%. Like, I mean, first of all, like, it seemed an unnecessary change at the best of times, because I don't think any of us were crying out for, you know, oh, I wish there was an extra 5 minutes of injury time, unless, of course, you know, there's an injury. But, like, so again, it's just, it comes across like changes for changes' sake. Like, it caught us all by surprise during the World Cup. And, you know, it's just the same now. So, again, what's really the point in all? If the point in all is to, you know, to get them actual football, well, still, I think, as Thomas Frank alludes to, like, the best way to combat that is to, you know, stricter refereeing, which, you know, to get the game moving, keep the game flowing, and clamp down on any attempts to time waste would be the best way to combat it. And then that way the players can, you know, avoid an extra 300 minutes, because, like, to go from 90 to, what was it, 104, you said, that's like 90 minutes plus extra, first half of extra time. So it's quite wild if you were to think, well, if you'd have just said, like, well, we're going to play 105 minute games, you'd be like, what? That's mental.
That's stupid.
So that's crazy. But it just seems unnecessary, to be honest. And it really does.
The other thing as well, I heard somebody else suggest this, you know, what's the end goal? Like, we're obviously never going to have the ball in play for 90 minutes, because that's impossible, and we never have had that. Like, what's what are you trying to achieve by this? Like, and where's the other thing that annoys me? Maybe this is more from a ref perspective, but where the fuck is the number coming from? Like, you're still just plucking it out of thin air, but rather than, like, having refereed the game and going, I actually can't really remember any stoppages, but there was a few subs and a couple of yellow cards, so I'll add on 3 minutes. You're going, I can't remember any stoppages, there was a few subs and a couple of yellow cards, I'll add on 8 minutes. Like, it just, yeah, there's no science to it.
The rationale for, like, how do they come up with the time is, again, just like most things in football, it's just like we're not kind of given the context as to why these things are the way they are. They just are. Just silliness again. Football Americanize it, if you like, yeah. so that the clock stops or anything like that when the ball's not in play. It's just not football, you know. You want
it
to be 9 minutes and then to- like.
Yeah, sorry,
but like, no, it's just like, again, it takes away from the, like, oh, well, we've got a team clinging on for dear life. They think maybe they will have got 2-3 minutes and then we'll see this out, and then fucking fourth official holds up a board with 10 minutes. Like, Jesus Christ, they've still got another 10 minutes of this. So, you know, it certainly doesn't help the sort of lesser teams that maybe try to cling on to a result, as opposed to, you know, giving the big boys Fergie time every game without even having to really ask for it. So.
And part of the skill of football, part of what makes it interesting against almost any other sport, is that sort of clock management. Maybe cricket, but cricket's on like a much larger scale, so you don't really, it's not really comparable. But yeah, football's got, like, you know, time management, clock management in that way. You're trying to slow the clock down. You're trying to eke the game out as much as possible, keeping the ball in the corner flag, taking your time on things. And that, like, you know, some folk are saying, I don't want to see that, but I don't know if that's the majority.
No, definitely not. I mean, like, yeah, like, without actually, like, I mean, when you've not got any skin in the race, yeah, I suppose you don't want to see that. But, like, as a Dunfermline fan, and I've seen some proper honking football teams come to East End Park, or I've gone with Dunfermline some proper honking football teams, and that's kind of the way they play, is to slow the game right down. So it is a tactical thing as much as anything else. It's just part of the game, is, you know, free flowing attacking football. But again, that's what makes football what it is. So you can, there are a million different ways to kind of cat. If you want to play ugly and grind out a result, you know, time wasting is going to come into that.
And then you end up in the Americanized thing as well, where the best teams just sort of automatically dominate and win most games. Like, it's really unusual. Football as a sport is really unique in the sense that the best team doesn't win always, and often doesn't win, you know, whereas in every other sport, basketball, American football, rugby, archery, like, the person that performs the best 99 times out of 100 ends up winning that game. And part of that is, yeah, like you say, it's game management. If you're saying to, I think I've seen people say, like, oh, teams now won't bother time wasting because they know it's just going to get added on at the end. And you're like, well, you know, if you're Luton and you're going to have to go to the Etihad this season and you're not even able to time waste and sort of manage and wind them up a little bit, and you've just got to, next they'll be saying, right, you have to play 2-4-4 with inverted wing backs against Man City just to open yourselves up even more and make it even more difficult. Silly argument, but you know, it's just, I find it frustrating. I hate, though I sound like an old man shouting at the wind, but like, it just feels like they're moving towards sort of stop clock stuff, which I just think is a nuclear change in what football actually is, and really, really don't want to see it.
Like, again, to go back to when we were talking about, like, maybe years ago, what is now VAR, is that something you could implement in football? And the argument against it was, well, the thing about football is you only need to play a game of football, you only need goals. That's the only thing you need. Whereas now you would need a video referee. If you're going to follow exactly what you see on a football pitch, you would, you know, a TV station, a stopwatch, a guy constantly like, oh, that's out, it's out of play, it's out of play, it's out of play. You know what I mean? So it doesn't, takes away from what makes the game so unique, in the sense that anybody could, you could just spring up a game of football in your living room if you want. All you need is posts or something to act as posts. But the more changes you make to it, the further away from that it becomes. That's not football.
Yeah, and then you end up like you do. You know, I play in a local basketball league, and often we don't play with shot clocks because there's nobody to manage it. Like, that's just, you just got to suck that up. And, you know, played American football and you're playing it with one referee who's, you know, whereas in the NFL you play with like six or seven referees, and so that makes part of the games completely different to how it would be, and certain things can't happen. And yeah, so you just don't really want football to go that way. We're getting very existential, Mike. You maybe try to bring it back around to some kind of semblance of sensibility and what they're trying to achieve before we move on.
Well, I think they are just trying to make it more puritanical, the game, trying to really just iron out the edges of all the shithousing elements of it, which me personally,
that's not what we want on this podcast.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think they're just trying to make the game in its purest sense, I suppose. And I don't know if they do want to get to the stopwatch timing, because I think Howard Webb said something about that, like it wasn't really feasible. So that was an interesting takeaway, considering he's in charge of the ref base in this country, which is obviously a big thing. And what's it? IFAB is created by the Scottish and English FAs, I don't know if we'll touch on this. IFAB is basically the people that make the rules and hand them down, but obviously because we made the game as a collective in this country, that we're in a big piece of charge of that. So I suppose Howard Webb would have some insight to that as well. So I don't know what their end goal is necessarily, apart from really just trying to iron out the finer edges to make it more palatable, I suppose, to a broader audience and try and bring more people in. I don't even think it's necessarily more advertising friendly either, because media companies didn't come when this game's going to finish. Like you said, if we're going on to 105 minutes, 110 minutes, I mean, that fucks with schedules as well. So I'm not sure who in the strictest sense it's who it's for, but we're just like, I guess in a sense we'll have to see if it plays out, if it calms down the stoppage time to a reasonable amount of time rather than this nonsense playing an extra period of football effectively at the end of these games.
Yeah, it's definitely not for match-going fans either, who, after they've been soaked through in the middle of December, the last thing they want to see is 18 minutes added on at the game when they can go to the pub.
I think it was Sutton United in League 2 or something, were 5-1 up or 5-1 down, I can't recall, and there was 8 added minutes at the end of the game. It's like, who's that for? They're not going to mount a comeback in those minutes. You can just say 2 or 3 and you just kind of accept the fact and get back up the road.
All 22 players on the pitch at that point are like, come away, ref. Like, fucking hell. Let me get in the shower, man. Not a beer. This is horrendous. The others we've seen, there was an increase in yellows for delaying. We've seen a couple in the Arsenal game. There's a couple in the Man United game last night. And they're being dished out, like, pretty, I was going to say leniently, that's the exact opposite of what I want to say. But like, it's not taking much from the players. Sort of like, you know, if you're about to take a throw, the Wolves boy got booked last night taking a throw for sort of looking at three different players and none of them being free. And the referee was like, right, booking. And
should have seen that Jim Jeffries done thrilling, by the way. Every fucking throw would have been a fucking
and like well, in the Man City Arsenal game, you had Bernardo Silva thought the throw-in was his and it wasn't, and he sort of just rolls the ball along the ground about 3 yards and he gets cautioned for that. So and equally now we're seeing yellows for the fake yellow, which was a thing about 10 years ago, and then they seem to get bored of it, and now it seems to be back. As somebody was complaining about it and saying that it's a bit soft, but at the end of the day, you're being a grass, and I completely condone that there should be a yellow card for folk being a grass. I'll be interested to see sort of what larger impact that has potentially on suspensions or sending offs in games. And we look at, there was 42 yellow cards this weekend, which is an average of 4.2 a game. Last season, there was 3.69 a game. Season before, there was 3.5. Obviously, if we maintain that average, that would represent a significant increase in yellow cards, but we'll need to wait and see. Interestingly, 42 yellows, but only 19 teams received a booking. But which team didn't receive a booking?
That's interesting. No, it's not Brighton. Brighton got two early doors. I'd guess.
Is it Newcastle?
There's a double irony to it. So the only team that didn't get a caution over the weekend was Burnley, who you would assume would get a caution, but then equally they did get a man sent off for a straight red card in the 94th minute instead. So every team received a card, but Burnley's was red and everybody else's were yellow. And yeah, Mike, you wanted to touch on changes to the coverage of football. I feel like every season there's a few tweaks, but this season it felt like there was some quite significant tweaks. You got TNT is in place of BT, which was sort of touted as just being a name change, but it certainly seemed to me to be a little bit more than that from everything that we were seeing that they were putting on. Not least that they've moved up to the fourth sports channel on Sky, which I was like, "Oh, you fucker, look how high they are." That's usually reserved for Sky Sports Darts or Sky Sports Cricket or something like that. Now TNT, Peter Drury on Sky, a new Soccer Saturday with Mike Dean on the panel, which I didn't get a chance to watch, but I did notice that Twitter didn't seem to approve of it very much. I said it was absolutely shite, but maybe that's just because Mike Dean was on it. But yeah, Mike, it's maybe the biggest changes we're seeing in football coverage, and we certainly said last season it was probably overdue.
Well, obviously, Jeff Sterling going, Martin Tyler going. I mean, he was the voice of Sky Sports since his inception of the Premier League before we were even born. So I think it is, like, obviously there's no Soccer AM anymore. I do think you're seeing a change in approach, not all for the better, I'd say, but I think you are seeing a broader approach. And I suppose the TNT one is interesting, just that one point out. It's like, I think all their lead anchors are female. And I actually think that the likes of Lindsay Hipgrave, who's done the 12:30 slot for a while now, and like if it's Kelly Cates that does the Friday night football, I do think they're actually measurably better than the men outside of, I think Mark Chapman's only like the male lead, I'd say, who's tolerable to watch. So I think
it's a fan of Dave Jones.
Nah, it tries to be too pally with Graeme Souness all the time and gets knocked back every 10 minutes. So I do think there's a refreshing approach to that as well. Like you're now seeing, I suppose, the balance of coverage as well is like the women are getting a chance. So I think that's also good. But like stuff like Soccer Saturday, like in a sense, it's kind of had its day with a smartphone and that. Like you can get the. Don't need to sit in the house on a Saturday. You can get the goals and the scores on your phone now. So I think that's kind of detracted from what it is. I know Peter Walton had his bit to say, like, didn't they get retained by TNT Sports? But, like, you've got to have an opinion if you want me on TNT Sports these days, Peter. So that's not going to help you. But I thought, like, including Alan McCoist into the commentary as well. Most people are a fan of him. So I think it's better to have people who are also engaging and entertaining when you're watching the game. if they can match that up in the schedule with people who can really analyse and break down the coverage as well, I think that's a positive way going forward rather than having the same old tired cliches rolled out every 5 minutes.
Yeah, I think you make a lot of salient points. I think Soccer Saturday, like you said, sort of had its day. I'd sort of, when I was going to watch something like that, would find myself watching the B team on a little bit more, yeah, just because there was a little bit more kind of conversation about what was going on between them. And that seems to be the direction Soccer Saturday's taking as well. But I, like you say, you can get the scores on your phone immediately now if you need them. It's not like days of yore. And I think the only thing for me on the coverage over the weekend is that I'm all for, like, don't sound miserable, I'm all for, like, entertainment, and I appreciate that's what they want with football. But, like, there is definitely we're definitely towing a line at the moment before it becoming just, like, you know, watching League of Their Own present Monday Night Football or League of Their Own present Soccer Sunday or whatever it is. Because I thought the whole Daniel Sturridge and Micah Richards...
Roy Keane as the annoyed uncle.
Super Sunday with Roy Keane being raging was a little bit cringy. Like, oh, mine Sturridge, and he is quite good fun, but the whole, like, you know, singing Usher and saying weird lines to Trent and shit like that, I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, like, can one of you actually just talk about the game, please? Like, I want to know what Chelsea are lacking in central midfield, and I want to know what you made of Ben Chilwell playing further up on the left and stuff like that. I really would really, really, really like a channel to just get some journalists on the panel. I'm fine with, you know, Richards and Sturridge and Keane and whatnot, but just, yeah, a little bit. I think the old BT Champions League coverage, when it wasn't an English team, was actually the best coverage on any channel, where you had
James Horncastle,
Honigstein. Yeah, Julian Laurent, like journos who know the league inside out, who know the players inside out, who can speak to tactics and analytics, and then occasionally you'd have an Owen Hargreaves in amongst them, something like that, who would discuss sort of things from a player's perspective. I think I wish somebody would try and do something with that. There must be journalists that are suitable for TV as well. They can't all be boring.
It's got to be a balance between, you know, colour and play-by-play, isn't it? So, yeah. Like, I know they're wrestling commentators, but JR and King were really good at that. You'd have that if you wanted to be serious, you'd hand over to JR, and if you wanted a bit more flair, you would hand over to King. And
well, that's what
Alan McCoist,
isn't it? Alan McCoist
is the King. And whoever is it, who's he normally team up with?
It'll be Derek Ray now, will it not?
Yeah. So that's you know, sort of the balance you're looking for as far as commentators are concerned. For what I saw, it was just, as you say, straight too far into colour and not enough into the analytics of the game. Whereas, like, maybe last season with the Sooners, it was too much the other way. But I thought, like, what,
too much old men shouting at the wind.
Yeah, exactly. What was it, Carragher and Gary Neville had a wee fucking throw about American football with the new Burnley investor, whatever his fucking name is.
JJ Watt, yeah.
That's the fella. I'm like, what the fuck is this? Like, it was cringy. And that's, you know, like, I mean, it doesn't detract from, you know, the game, which is what we're all there to see anyway. So it's neither here nor there. And it is just like a good diverse range of, you know, as my, like, anchors and stuff who I think are a breath of fresh air, but the pundits are still mostly shite.
Yeah, it's just...
As you say, they're former players, but they're not. And that's it. I don't want to see... I think that's probably one change we can make straight away is less players in the game. And the punditry and all that. Most of them don't know the fucking rules for a start. So, yeah. So
I think you notice it if you are a podcast listener. Like, if you do listen to the sort of big ticket podcasts like The Athletic or The Guardian, and they have journalists on all the time, and very, very rarely have ex-players on, and just the difference that you get in the sort of I think the big thing for me is often their analysis is more nuanced and it's much more like balanced, and it's less, you know, Trent Alexander-Arnold is absolutely terrible and he can't possibly defend and he doesn't have a career at Liverpool. And you're like, well, you know, none of those things are true. Like, the guy's a Premier League football player. He's obviously like, you know, let's look at this with a bit more of an analytical mind, you know, what's going wrong and stuff. So, I think it's interesting.
And plus, like, without being like too harsh on the boys, it's like, sometimes the punditry is that you could, well, obviously, once your playing career finished, you weren't good enough to make it as a coach or to make it in, like, stay in the game in that kind of professional setup. So you have to, you know, make an arse of yourself in a studio to stay relevant or, you know, rather than just retire. So there's always an element of that. But yeah.
And let's be honest, we're all a little bit jealous because I wouldn't half mind spending 5 hours on a Sunday standing pitch side just talking pish about football and getting paid an absolute fortune for it. That would be quite nice. Right, talking of football, rather than talking about football, let's talk about some football. And let's start with the game at Old Trafford last night. An absolute corker, I must say, between Manchester United and Wolves, where Man United came out 1-0 winners.
Bruno Fernandes, nice pass. Wan-Bissaka, surely! Manchester United's first goal of the season, and it's a wrap and run.
Man United come away with a 1-0 win, but somewhat fortuitously, after their game against Wolves, the big decision at the end, which I suppose we should probably just start with, let's be honest, it's the major talking point of the game. Onana, who had a reasonably solid game, but certainly showed glimpses of a potential mistake in him, came flying out for a cross, absolutely nowhere near it. Two hands around two Wolves players, chested them both to the ground. VAR had a look, said no doing. Simon Hooper, wasn't it? And the two VAR officials have all been rested for this weekend by the PGMOL, which tells you all you need to know about the decision. Mike, you laughed that you had definitely seen this decision despite missing the game itself. What did you make of it?
Clear and obvious comes to mind into the decision making. I can understand like making a mistake, like mistakes happen all the time, but that's what the VAR's for, to look at these kind of mistakes if you miss it in real time, and how you can come to that conclusion of a goalkeeper just absolutely clattering two boys. I mean, not even just the one boy, two boys getting nowhere near the ball. You know, I mean, just because it's a goalkeeper. So that just seemed very strange. And I think it's a Michael Salisbury. He was involved in the VAR room between Tottenham and Brighton when Mutoma was denied a penalty and Højbjerg clipped him, and he was taken off VAR for 3.5 weeks there. So fuck knows what he's doing, if he can't work a monitor or something. Like he's missing these big calls, because that's the only reason I could fathom, unless they're just getting too much into the weeds about these things. But then you see like the littlest thing is getting pulled up. So I kind of like wrap my head around why you could miss something as clear and obvious, in my opinion, as that.
There's not really any two ways about it, is there, Sheila? It's hard to come to any other conclusion.
It's a clear foul. And anywhere else on the pitch, like if that's not in the box and a centre half runs and gets nowhere near the ball and catches the boy, it's definitely going to be a free kick. So, no, say that the actual decision not to give a penalty doesn't make any sense. But, it is what it is, I suppose. I'm sure there'll be other controversial calls throughout the season. Just Man United happen to be the beneficiaries of this one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's probably even harsher for Wolves, Sheila, because they were comfortably the better team.
Well, hi, but you say harsher. I mean, football has a sort of an irony about it. If you don't take your chances, then it'll come back to haunt you one way or another. And it was double jeopardy for Wolves, since obviously they conceded and then they weren't given a penalty. But if Gary O'Neill was like, oh, but we didn't get a point because we didn't get a penalty, that would be completely untrue. You got didn't get a point because your strikers are shite. and that's all there is to it. So I think if you're sort of Wolves, it gave you a get out clause for what should have been probably 3 points, never mind 1 point. But yeah, just kind of spared their blushes. So we're talking about that penalty decision as opposed to how wasteful they were.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? Because the sort of narrative of the game is actually that, oh, Wolves look fantastic and that they might be much better this season and they were vastly more attacking. But equally, you know, you're unlikely to get teams like Man United on an off day every week. And, you know, if they come across somebody on a good day, you can't get away with spurning circa 2.5 XG. You know, Cunha missing from all the 2 yards hitting the outside of the post, despite otherwise having a great game. You know, he carried the ball really well. He did that thing where you break the lines, commit defenders, and then try and feed other players in. Neto had a couple of good chances, and the guy, Fabio Silva, the sort of...
Sarabia as well.
But Sarabia's pish. We said he was pish when he arrived, and he's proven that he's pish. Fabio Silva missed two up. Like, he had two at the end where they were both on the turn, both about 12 yards out, and he just smashes them both at Onana, and you're like, just put it anywhere else. So, yeah, a sore one. For Man United, Mike, sort of a similar story. They obviously had a famously bad start to the season last year and managed to solidify themselves and turn it around. And so, performance-wise, similar story, but they've come out of it with 3 points this time, which I'm sure Ten Hag will be delighted about. However, a number of players putting in subpar performances, and particularly Lisandro Martinez, who is sort of his blue-eyed boy getting hooked after 45 minutes. He was cautioned for a ludicrous tackle in the first half and then had another foul afterwards, arguably not, I don't think he should have been, but it was arguable whether he should have been on the pitch. And you know, it's not an exciting, harmonious start to the season for United, albeit you'll be happy with the result.
No, but again, it's just one game. Still got the 3 points and don't need to be all too much doom and gloom with it. Like, people could have poor performances, people have poor starts to the season. It's not the end of the world, but it's interesting that this was a team whose manager left 4 days ago. They got the new guy in 2 days ago, and Wolves looked like the team that had the more experienced kind of cohesive unit, which was strange because it's like nothing much has changed with Man United. They've not got a fit number nine, like that was the same last season, and they were okay with that. Mount comes into midfield, had a bit more energy and dynamism. Okay, he's still got to get to the nuances with his teammates. But again, it, in many ways, it's an upgrade in Ten Hag's system to what Christian Eriksen or Scott McTominay or Fred would be. So I think it's just a case of really just that. See, some teammates getting used to one another. Onana needs to really take it down a few notches. He's going to be number one. I don't think he has to worry about Dean Henderson breathing down his neck, so he doesn't have to be the big hero that he sometimes purports to be. So I think, yeah, you can just say about Man United, like, they got the job done at the end of the day, but if they don't buck up their ideas, of course they'll have stiffer tests to face than plucky Wolves.
Yeah, absolutely. First game. Sheila, we didn't really get a chance to hear your predictions for this season, and I assume they won't have changed greatly after the first game. Where did you have Wolves and Man United?
So I thought Wolves would be running about the bottom three. I actually probably fancy them to get relegated. So yeah, the performance last night caught me by surprise. They looked very un-Wolves-like, but with a similar goal tally, however. and then Man United, I did fancy to have a better season, maybe third, but like a good third, not like a we just kind of scrape it. With the signings that they made, who I think are definitely all upgrades. So, but again, the first game of the season is always a bit of a wild card. You never quite know what you're going to get. And I do think once they get their new striker into the team, it will change things a bit. I just thought that, you know, the midfield didn't really click as Ten Hag would have hoped. So there was a lot of a lot on Casemiro to clear up, which on this occasion he didn't really do. But normally we'd have like sort of Eriksen a bit deeper to help him out, whereas Mount obviously likes to play a bit more advanced, certainly at this stage in their respective careers than Eriksen does. So I think it's just as Mike says, just a bit of getting used to the system and how each sort of players want to play. But yeah, and can't blame De Gea or Maguire for not being able to play at the back because he's had his own, you know, they've got their own. Ten Hag's kind of run out of excuses now that he's managed to get the players he wants and try and implement the system he wants. So yeah, hope he doesn't make a rod for his own back. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the other thing on Casemiro as well is that without the striker being fit, Rashford's playing through the middle, which then means you're playing both of Garnacho and Antony, alternatively Sancho coming in, and I don't think either of them retained possession one in two times they had the ball. You know, they both gave away the ball often.
Like they're not necessarily, you know, possession based players. They definitely try and take on their fullback, and it's not going to work every single time. So again, it's maybe something Ten Hag wants to rein in a bit and just like no. It doesn't have to go straight. You don't have to go for the jugular every single time. A little bit more patience might serve you well, considering you're expecting Man United to dominate the ball in most of their games. So, yeah, maybe both of them really didn't work. Something maybe could be addressed moving forward. But as I say, once you get a number nine out, you can take one of those variables off the table and you can have like one of them who's willing to do that. But it's
Rashford, both who's flanks, a bit more reliable.
Exactly. Rashford, definitely more experienced and knows how to manage a game a bit better than us too. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Sorry?
No, I just said food for thought.
Food for thought. It is always a bit funny being like analytical after the first game, isn't it? It's that's why we didn't do it in season one. We thought, fuck that. We'll just wait till game week three. Yeah, because there's not really the sort of stories haven't unfolded yet, have they, that you're usually sort of following throughout the season. You're kind of just at the intro stage where you're potentially introducing them. But over to the bridge, Chelsea 1, Liverpool 1.
Fernandes, Szoboszlai clear, back in by Chilwell.
Interesting game, exciting game, Mike. Both teams sort of playing some I was going to say all hell to the wind. I'm having a nightmare with my phrases tonight. What am I trying to say? All
hell for leather.
Hell, I think I'm trying to say hell for leather and throw caution to the wind. I'm throwing both of those together. Throw hell to the wind. Aye, they both went for it, Mike, for various reasons, but exciting. Liverpool looked great for half an hour. Chelsea really grew into the game and looked pretty good for the next sort of 30, 40 minutes and then calmed down a wee bit at the end. But yeah, exciting one to watch anyway.
Yeah, it's just nice to see a Chelsea-Liverpool game with a goal in it for a change. yeah, I think you summed it up pretty well, actually. I thought when Salah went through in the first instance to put the ball in the back of the net to potentially make it Liverpool 2-0, then I thought they would have been out of sight, but you're right, the Chelsea pegged them back, and I think Nick Jackson looks interesting in what he's doing. He does a lot of running off the ball, very important for a centre-forward these days to be making those kind of moves, but I think you've hit the nail on the head. Like, both teams were kind of so attacking because they knew they can't fucking defend either of them, so try to cancel themselves out in that instinct. And obviously you've said in the notes there about holding midfielders, like Liverpool don't have a midfielder, kind of just stitching it together at the moment. It's got no cohesion, kind of no kind of forward planning. They don't have much experience, even though you could say like McAllister's won the World Cup, still relatively young man, still be taking a move up into the Champions League. Of course they're not in the Champions League this season, but to a bigger team than Brighton, of course. And I think it's going to take time to kind of knit itself together, but they do need reinforcements, but Chelsea's picking them off, aren't they?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. I think Sheila, just based on the game itself, Chelsea probably come out of that feeling more positive, but maybe because they came from a lower ebb than Liverpool did last season. And maybe, you know, they look like the team probably more likely to win it. And early signs for the Pochettino revolution look quite good. And obviously one signing confirmed, potentially two more coming in this week as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what you'd expect for Pochettino teams, 4-3-3, very attacking. And that'll be good for Chelsea fans, make a nice change for the past year to see them actually, you know, kind of go for it. As I say, there's still a lot of work to be done in both of those teams. I don't think even the signing of Casado, while he's part of the solution, there's still a lot of work to be done in forward areas. If Jackson's the striker for this season until Nkuku becomes fit, what do you do with the likes of Sterling or Madueke or Mudryk or Malisi when he's eventually fit? So there's still a lot of questions about this Chelsea team and what the best 11 will look like. For Liverpool, again, just there's so many options up front. It's like Klopp doesn't know what his best front three is. You know, obviously, you fancy Salah to be a part of that. Maybe Diaz is probably the front runner from the left, but who's going to be the guy through the middle? Is it Nunes? Is it Gakpo? Is it Jota? Three pretty, very different players, and then obviously you've got the missing piece in the whole midfield, which, despite their best efforts to fill, it's still vacant. So, yeah, it's going to be an interesting season for both these clubs. I don't really see either of them being able to lay a glove on City or Arsenal or even Man United, but yeah, improvements, I would say. So it's positive for both, but Chelsea more for it.
Interesting final team to lump in there, but yeah, intriguing. Largely fair points at Caicedo. Is a big signing for Chelsea. I think he is sort of the closest thing to a replacement to Kante that they could get. You know, he's got that energy, seems good on the ball. I'll be honest, I think I asked Mike, I said to Mike last week, like, you know, is he, when the fee was 111 million quid, I was like, you can't see that good. Like, everybody says he's good, but
he's not. I think Brighton have had Chelsea's pants down, to be honest.
But then again, it's like, you know, there's such a dearth of actual holding midfielders, you know, and they're going to get Lavia as well, it looks like, for 55. And then Liverpool are like, well, fuck, there's who else actually is there? You know, genuinely, like, what other players are there?
I just don't understand the rationale, really. I mean, like, I think if you didn't get Casado, then Latvia would be the next best thing. I don't understand why you would sign both. I really don't.
I was going to say number of games this season isn't a huge issue, but going forward,
I know that you're wanting three ends up to do things in more forward areas, but if push came to shove, then, you know, he could play that role.
He was sort of trying to play it at the weekend, wasn't he? And he definitely needs somebody alongside him. And I suppose Poch's preferred formation is 4-2-3-1, so then you could play Lavia and Caicedo, you could play Enzo in the three. It gives you a few more options rather than just having... Well, the problem for Chelsea for the last 5 years is they've had Kante and no one else. And if Kante's fucked, Chelsea have been fucked. Sort of dragged them to a title and to a Champions League in that time. And so maybe just a bit of cover, but yeah.
So you could have probably just kept Kante and signed one or the other.
Although he was broken as well, wasn't he?
Was a bit broken, but
170 million quid on two boys in the same position. What's there to moan about? Chuck them on 8-year contracts.
Again, like, look, and a serious note, like, this is exactly what kind of Chelsea's problem was last season. They had so many players, and no one really knew who was the best fit. Like, right, okay, Reece James is the right back. But then after that, who the fuck plays where? No one knows.
Well, Chilwell played left wing on the weekend.
He did, and he looked good. So you'd figure he's edged it over Cucurella, but
No, no, but he didn't. But not even left back, like left wing, wing, like actual, yeah. like
left when the Paddy Boyle left. Yeah. So yeah, if Chelsea are sorted at full back, although Reece James has seemingly made it a butter. After that, there's still the same problems exist. Like, how much game time is Mudryk going to get? And he desperately needs it as well to kind of catch up. You don't think he's actually had that time, like game
and
time.
It's certainly a surprise that Chukwuemeka started on Sunday, I think, to most folk.
That's what I mean. Like, where does this guy come from now? And it consistently upsets the apple cart. And it's, you know, like, to put it, like, to reverse it, like, City, right, obviously they rotate a lot, but they still know that if Pep wants to pick his best 11, he still knows what it is. And it just chops and changes depending on the opposition. I don't think Chelsea are any closer to finding out who the best 11 is. Oh, no,
definitely not. Definitely not.
So the first names on the team sheet would be Reece James.
Sanchez, because he's the only goalie we've actually got.
Yeah, almost, yeah. Reece James.
Probably touched upon that grill, though, because, like, what the fuck's that about loaning Kepa out to Real Madrid and getting Brighton's number?
Two, three. Yeah, and number. Well, we got in Brighton's number two to be our number two, but then agreed for Kepa to go to Real Madrid, making him our number one, and now are potentially in for Magic Mike from AC Milan, which
and
would Kepa's come.
Also, yes, Spain's number two, and Sanchez is Spain's number four, and then Arsenal just got Spain's number three to come into their squad to improve the goalkeeping situation. And, like, Chelsea are just fucking pissing and rotating goalkeepers. It's madness, really. Amazing.
Sanchez looked all right on Sunday, I thought. But
Sanchez is a good goalie. There's no doubt about that. He just fell out of favour with Deserbi for whatever reason. But, again, just what's the joined up thinking at Chelsea? It just feels like they're signing everyone. They're linked with everyone. See, if you look through Twitter, it's just like, oh, now we can go sign this player and this player.
Alisi is the one that I think is a step too far. I think signing Lavia and Caicedo is fine. Like, we need Caicedo. We needed Lavia. Right, we get both. That's probably sensible. You know, Man City had Fernandinho and Rodri for about four seasons who are literally the same player. You know, has anybody seen them in the same room together? Like, it works if you've got a manager that can handle it, and we've got the best manager that's available that might be able to handle it. So if anybody's going to do it, it's Poch. But Alisse seems like, come on, man. We've got his wingers. Like, we just got rid of three wingers to Saudi Arabia. Why are we getting more wingers?
But that's the thing. Like, and again, to go into the spend and SFP and all that, like, the Saudis came along at the right time for Chelsea.
Oh, yeah.
They solved that problem as far as shedding players, and then they've just done it again. Like,
the message at the start of summer was Chelsea need to sell to buy, and we've sold about 60 million quid's worth of talent and bought like 350 million quid's worth of talent. Where was the other 200 million pounds
come like,
from?
It's like in Still Game when Jack and Victor get the funeral plan. It's like free money. just go and spend on frivolous things.
There's basically a balance of 300 million.
I mean, that's just like the football manager. Like, you just fucking piddle around with the sliders with the transfer budget and the wages. Like,
and the wages.
We've got most of the wages after books. We just put it on to the transfer kitty and then we just fucking.
And then sign 21-year-olds that don't know how much they're worth. And
just the filter release clause and see if you can afford them. And that's basically what Chelsea are doing at the moment.
And Chelsea fans are obviously making a big deal that Caicedo chose Chelsea over Liverpool. And I'm sure there's an element of the 2020 photo with his mum wearing a Chelsea top, which is really cute. But there's probably also an element of Liverpool were apparently offering him 150 grand a week for on a four-year contract, and Chelsea are offering him 350 grand a week on an eight-year contract.
Yeah, it was that. Like, again, when you're all thrown around eight-year contracts, like, you've got to take that, surely, as a... Mm. Like, playing for Chelsea for 8 years, and it doesn't matter whether you're good or shite, you'll still get your 300k a week for the rest of your 30s, the rest of your 20s. So,
yeah, but equally for Chelsea, you know, if it is exciting in the sense that Chelsea are arguably in what like Arteta's first season was, where they start buying under 24 year olds who could be good in a couple of years and stitch them together.
I don't remember Arteta spending 100 odd million.
No, not obviously, but that's because Chelsea are operating at the top level of the market. Arteta had to
You know, they've got like sort of deep pockets, short arms. The one they've got a fucking owner who's just gone mental.
It's a laugh, isn't it?
Yeah, Craig Levine. It's some laugh.
And then we should speak about Liverpool and particularly from a transfer sense. Literally on this podcast, 18 months ago when they signed Luis Diaz in his first two games, we were like, yes, Liverpool are the model. This is how they go out. They identify a player that fills a hole. He comes in, he fills the hole. He's brilliant. Since then, they've spent 80-odd million on Darwin Nunes, who 12 months down the line isn't showing his value. They spent 35 million on Cody Gakpo. 6 months down the line, isn't showing his value. They've just missed out on 110 million quid for Caicedo. They're going to miss out on 55 million quid to spend on Lavia. They've lost Henderson. They've lost Fabinho. They need a holding midfielder and none exist. It's, Mike, they've sort of, for all the kind of comedy spending at Chelsea, Liverpool have certainly been uncharacteristically poor in the market now for probably since that Luis signing.
It's the it's kind of simple in a sense. They lost Michael Edwards, who was their sporting director, and the contingency plan's obviously not been put together well. And he left at the end of the start of last year's summer window. So obviously he had some contingency plans in there, in the sense that he was handing over the reins, and he would have gave like a detailed kind of plan to the next guy in charge, but. Like I said, that a year down the line, like that's not necessarily come to fruition. And now you've got yourself in a hole where, okay, they've been pushed in a sense because the Saudi money's really ripped their midfield out. But I don't think losing Fabinho and Henderson's a massive loss for them in terms of who they are as players. But obviously they've had no contingency plan to, well, outside of bringing in two guys who always wanted to go to Chelsea in the first place anyway. But that's just, again, that's just poor foresight and planning anyway. If the whole world knew about those two players want to go to Chelsea, then try to push and show your hand in a sense that you're going to pay this amount of money, and now you've shown your desperation that you have to go to the third choice guy and the third choice team with 2 weeks to go in the window and say, right, we want to, say you wanted Kamara from Aston Villa, for example, and they go, well, you wanted Blavia for 55 and Casido for 110. If you want Kamara this late in the window, you want 75 million for him. And you just put yourself in a precarious position where you're going to use up all your Saudi resources and fuck the whole thing for yourself because you've already spent good money on players over the last three windows anyway.
Yeah, and you know, Judy's out on Alexis McAllister yet. Not saying I don't say that in the sense that he was bad on Sunday. I just mean, you know, he's had one game, so we don't know how successful that signing will be.
I think they will be successful signings, but they're missing the vital piece of the puzzle that glues it all together. So it's no point having Szoboszlai and McAllister really the third piece. So that's the predicament they're in. But it's, as you say, it's very un-Liverpool. Like, and both teams are just kind of went. Like, again, we know that City are the model. Maybe Arsenal now are second to that, the way they've identified the player and they've went out and gone. I mean, maybe the Rice thing dragged on a little bit longer than they'd like, but they've got their man in the end. Whereas Chelsea and Liverpool are just being linked with this player and that player.
Well, Chelsea certainly get their targets.
Yeah, but at what cost? And they have to sign them for like the rest of their lives. But like both teams are giving me very post Fergie Man United vibes, where linked with everybody spending well over.
Well, I did see Liverpool compared to late Wenger era Arsenal, in the sense that like Klopp is, because things aren't going perfectly, he's almost pulling in more and more of the control to himself and becoming more of a dictator, and actually. Then there's less people to challenge him, and so he grows less and develops and changes less, and that makes things worse, which is roughly, in 50 words or less, what happened to Wenger, which I think is quite an interesting comparison, given he's now sort of, what, 8 seasons in, and when did they win the league? 2020? COVID season 20. Yeah, it was. Yeah, 2020. So, you know, three seasons now without a major trophy for a guy that was chapping at the door his entire time, you can sort of maybe see the cracks showing a wee bit, although we did say that last year as well, and he hung around. Whereas Chelsea's all vibes, man. All this negativity in it. Like, you can be negative about Liverpool. Chelsea's fun. Fun in games and vibes and happiness, and we're going to finish fourth or third and we'll have a laugh while we do it. Talking of which, Sheila, what were your predictions for these two?
I can see Liverpool getting fourth. Chelsea maybe sixth.
So that means you must have Newcastle going, like, fifth.
City, Arsenal, Man United, Liverpool, Newcastle, oof, Chelsea.
Oh, Sheila's not going to be winning any prizes at the end of the season for predictions. Mike, sorry, did I interrupt? Were you about to jump in there just to finish off?
I was just looking at the transfers, and obviously Henderson and Fabinho being in the big ticket items, but you've also got Oxlade-Chamberlain leaving. Okay, that's not necessarily a massive loss. Milner leaving as well, and Naby Keita. So that's five experienced midfielders from that you've lost, and you've only really brought in
two.
Well, I was going to say one and a half, really, because Szoboszlai's not really a midfielder. He's kind of like that half wing kind of position. McAllister's, I think you say McAllister's a midfielder. And Gakpo, again, he's really kind of more of that trident up top as well. So, like, he's only really got one midfielder to replace the five that have left him. So it's not even just a case of getting that number six. It's getting that number six, and can we get a few more boys in there as well? Because, yeah, it's looking pretty thin at the moment.
Yeah, and Bacicic was looking like he might have, you know, filled that hole maybe this time last year, but he's still not an out-and-out six, and he definitely can't play every week, you would think.
Oh, and I don't think Curtis Jones is the answer either that they're looking for.
Curtis Jones is going to end up at Norwich in the Championship, isn't he? And still not quite make it. He's going to be like a Nathan Redmond. That's sort of where I see his career going. No disrespect to Nathan Redmond, who's obviously had a stellar top-flight career, but I do remember when he was like England's big saviour and he was going to change our fortunes after the golden generation, and you think, fucking hell, somebody was clearly clutching at straws then. Moving on, Brentford 2, Tottenham 2.
Madison in a relegated Leicester City side last season, the shining light. 8 Premier League free kicks to his name. He stands over his first for Spurs. Yeah! Oh, it's turned out absolutely perfectly. Christian Romero meets the free kick from Madison.
And knocks himself out in the process. An absolute thunderbolt of a free kick from James Maddison. And yeah, you know it's bad when you can hear it the way it hits Christian Romero and Ange Postecoglou. Well, I was going to say forced to take him off. Actually, it wasn't forced at all. He was unforced to take him off and decided to take him off, which is quite the stance from the new Australian at Tottenham. Exciting first half this, Sheila. I'm just a bit all over the place, to be honest. Tottenham looked like they could be quite good fun this year. The Ange revolution looks exciting for Spurs fans. At least they're sort of, I'm jokingly saying about Chelsea, at least it's all vibes and happiness and positivity. It kind of, Spurs had a feel of that, that even if it's not their most successful season in points total, they might have a little bit more fun doing it than they have done for under Nuno, Conte and Jose.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's just total opposite to those three guys as Ange style. And I hope he's given time, even if, you know, the points don't come straight away. I hope he's given time, because I think long term it will pan out for him and Spurs. Because I think, like, even the early signs, I think if they were down behind to Brentford last season, that'd have been it. Mm. They would have huffed and puffed and not really done anything. Whereas they managed to drag themselves back into the game and actually go ahead. But then obviously the defensive frailties is creeping as they have done. But no, it's good. Tottenham are going to be very excited to watch. It could be lots of goals at both ends for them.
Equally, Mike, Brentford looked like they just sort of carried on from where they left off. No Ivan Toney, but it didn't seem to matter. They had Wissa and Mbeumo up front. sort of running riot. They had Rico Henry, who missed a big chunk of last season because of injury, and he seemed to, you know, have Emerson Royale on toast at times in that first half, and maybe just dampened any potential worries that people might have had about them, sort of third season syndrome. Not that that's a thing, but, you know, second season syndrome in their third season. No Ivan Toney, but they looked good.
No, I thought they applied themselves very well, but that's never been the problem when they've been at home. It's more so the away form that's kind of let them down, but I think we've kind of been through this before. If you've got a system in place and got a belief and an ethos throughout the whole club, never mind just the first team, if a player drops out, then it's not going to be a big loss if you're able to just adjust that. The fact they've got Mbeumo and Wissa up top, kind of a wee change in approach there. Even like David Rea going to Arsenal, like that's been bubbling away in the background for months, and the sporting director said it was the way he's been in and around the ground training, even though he's been wanted away, his behaviour's been exemplary. Again, Flecken comes in for him. They've kind of got the ducks in a row, and it just seems like a really cohesive unit, and they'll be disappointed that they drew 2-2 against Tottenham. They've probably seen that as the potential scout, but they'll be in no trouble this season, and if they can keep building and keep going on, then Brentford will be one of these teams that would just become a norm in the Premier League going forward.
Yeah, they're certainly moving in that direction. Transfer chat, the big one for Spurs, obviously Harry Kane away, Sheila. Alan Shearer had his pilot's cap on match of the day. Delighted to see his Premier League record remain intact, at least for another season and a half until Haaland catches it. Interesting one, really, isn't it? Yeah, but first big ticket player to leave the Premier League for a while, maybe the biggest since Ronaldo. Going to Bayern is quite the statement from Bayern to sign, you know, probably number.
They're just a wee diddy club. I mean, really, no, no.
But I mean, generally,
like, they should have just stayed at Spurs. You know what I mean? Like, it's Bayern, they've never won fuck all. Who have they ever beat?
But in the context of European football, I can't recall a time where they've beaten a sort of Man City, Real Madrid, Barcelona financially to a player. They tend not to, despite their dominance, they tend not to be a...
No, because I don't think they've ever really needed to in the modern game. They've always managed to recruit within the Bundesliga and flex their muscles there. You know, Lewandowski's a great example of that. They got him from Dortmund at the same time that he was scoring 4 against Real Madrid in Champions League games. So they've never really had to, but now, like, maybe because there's not really an option like that available in the Bundesliga, especially at striker, they've had to go out for a Kane. And but as I say, like the discourse about whether he should go or not, because you know, everybody just gets medals, and anybody can get a medal in Germany. You know, you just put on a pair of boots and then you can win a winner's medal. You can walk right into the Bayern first team. With no sweat at all. But no, see, in a serious note, I'm surprised the move took as long as it did. But I say that, but like Daniel Levy certainly strikes me as an absolute bastard to negotiate with. But once you know that was agreed, it should really have been plain sailing from there. Because I think in that case, everyone's a winner. Bayern get their best, you know, chance to replace Lewandowski. Kane gets his move to a club that will win trophies and might even get a Champions League in that. And he goes to one of the sort of the institutions of European football. As much as Spurs would like claim that they are, they're not on Bayern's level. They never will.
They're
be
not an institution of English football. Never mind
you. No, exactly. You know what I mean? Like, I think, but Bayern are up there with maybe like, as far as like history and success in the modern day is concerned, like up there with like a Liverpool or a Man United.
Bayern, Liverpool, United, Real Madrid,
Real Madrid, Real Madrid,
AC Inter, Juve. That's your sort of...
Exactly, that's your, you know, your...
European heavyweights.
Your titans, if you like, even if they're not all on the same...
Aberdeen, of course.
Yeah, of course. They're not on the same level, maybe financially, as some of the teams in the Premier League, but... Yeah, it was, and then obviously Tottenham get their 100 million, which they can reinvest wherever they wish. They'll probably blow it, but nevertheless.
Who did they spend the bail money on again? Eric Miller.
A whole host of jobbers.
Yeah, it was like, what did they say? It was selling Elvis and buying the Beatles. That was the line at the time. And it must have been a shy Beatles because, like, it was Lemaire, it was that Romanian centre half that kicked around Delhi for a while.
Oh, I know who you're on about.
Was Lo Celso that time as well?
Lo Celso's a good bit after that.
Give me a second. Talk about
he's too. Lo Celso's...
Did they not sign Eriksen off for that? I'm sure they did.
They couldn't
have because he was no because he was there at the same time as Bale, so it couldn't have been. Yeah.
No, it was
Lamella was the one that was the best one.
Aye, Eric Lamella was the sort of like meant to be the world beater. There was definitely another attacker.
Was it not? It's not Janssen or Pavlyuchenko. No, Janssen. Is it not Janssen?
Let me just see if I can get
him to eat up. He's too recent as well, I think.
Sure, he was. Feels recent, but I don't think it's that recent.
Soldado, is it?
Yeah, Soldado's.
A good here we go. That. Sorry, here we go. Paulinho, Nasser Chadli, Soldado, Etienne Capoue, Vlad Churches, Christian Eriksen, and Eric Lamaire. That was the group of them.
Nasser Chadli, who ends up at West Brom and. Where did Churches end up? He ended up somewhere weird
He went to like maybe Fiorentina or something like that, or Calgary.
Napoli, Sassuolo, Cremonese, and he's back at...
still going, Christ.
Yeah, well, still at Bucharest.
Soldado was fucking root as well. Yeah,
Soldado
was
Villarreal, Fenerbahce, Granada, and just retired after Levante.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what they do with the Kane money, which is interestingly a similar value, but they'll get far fewer players for it.
Yeah, but like, you get one for that.
They might get Ivan Toney because Brentford know it's there.
But and then obviously the other benefit to Tottenham is they don't sell him to Premier League rival, which is what they would have wanted. And I think it's probably the best Kane could have hoped for, considering Real Madrid are probably going to wait till next year to sign Mbappe. So
I'm really intrigued to see how he gets on. I think he probably adds 4 years to his career.
He'll smash it. Again, I think he'll fit into Bayern really well. Because they already play with kind of his style of play in mind. You know, I'm not a German football expert, but I'm just kind of speculating that he'd be much better than Choupo-Moting. And he'll thrive in Bayern the same way that Lewandowski did.
Yeah, and he'll
get the trophy haul, and he'll still have the host of Spurs goals because he was a good servant to the club, stayed there against his will for a number of years.
So. I know, you must look at Haaland and think, fuck me, I could have two Premier Leagues and a Champions League by now, instead I've got fuck all.
Exactly, yeah, but... there you go.
And then he could stay in. And he could have stayed. And he could have got Alan Shearer's record. But Daniel Levy's a...
How much is that record really worth? And again...
I think it's worth much more in retirement than it is.
Than it is.
I reckon when you're playing. I reckon Kane probably doesn't really care about the Premier League record now.
The important thing about Shearer is he'd already won the league. He had that winner's medal relatively early in his career as well. So he was still able to go on for years after that, not giving a fuck whether he'd won it or not, because he'd already won it.
Yeah.
Again, it's different when you're sitting and you've already got the medal in the cabinet rather than the trophy in the cabinet, as opposed to, you know, Kane, who's got an Audi Cup to show for his Tottenham career.
And is, you know, never going to win the Champions League. They had their chance. In 2019, I want to say, against Liverpool, and that's not coming around again. You know, that was a perfect storm. So
the goals itself, like the Premier League record or the league record for English goals, in terms of the whole history of English,
he's miles off it.
Alan Shearer's 20th. You know what I mean? So it's like very like last 30 years kind of history kind of thing. It's like how much does that actually matter?
The Premier League, but think it was Kieran that hit it with, like, or Greg that was saying, like, aye, but some of those boys were playing against, like, X World War.
That was Dixie,
to
be fair. Dying, Dixie Dean playing against boys that PTSD, but you still have Jimmy Greaves in who holds the record, who's what, 60s yeah, and 70s, so it's
modern,
not
relatively modern times. But I
so yeah, Gerd yeah, Muller just either
revisionism for the English media there.
Yeah, absolutely. And even Alan Shearer gets 23 goals knocked off of his record because of it that he scored at Southampton in the old Division One. Let's move on. Newcastle 5, Aston Villa 1.
Anthony Martinez would have expected to save it, but here's Gordon. Oh, and 3-0! It is a dream start for the new boy and for Newcastle, Sandro Tonali on his debut.
Fantastic debut for Tonali. I said I wasn't going to draft him after we discussed that he was going to be shite for Newcastle, and I drafted him anyway, and then he scored, so I'm absolutely delighted. And he arguably could have had another. Generally, just a all-round phenomenal performance, really, on the first day from Newcastle. Mike, Villa looked very much in it for the first probably half an hour, equalised. Diaby looked quick, lively. Watkins had chances. The injury to Mings just seemed to derail sort of everything that was going on with them, and Newcastle took advantage and then some.
Yeah, as much as I've gave Tyrone Mings a whole bunch of shit on this podcast in the past, his importance, like, as a leader to that team is probably one of the most important in the Premier League. I think the drop-off of when he doesn't start to where he starts for Villa is stark, and obviously, because that's because he brings a lot to the team in terms of, like, you know, just his leadership capacity. He's able to really help out his defenders around him. And obviously, he just brings something to the team that G's them up. And obviously, when he went down with a bad knee injury that probably rules him out for the rest of the campaign, you're right, it did take the stuffing out of it. But I was listening to the game on the radio, and St. James's Park sounded absolutely electric, and that must have lifted the team up a few notches as well. And, like, what sports washing in action, is it? It's such good vibes around Newcastle United at the moment. Everybody's buying in on and off the field. And, like I said, to Tonali, like, okay, it's just one game, but it was a pretty good start for him. And, like, Isaac getting off the score sheet early doors after his kind of muddled campaign with injury last time out. I didn't see it coming, but I think Mickey Richards had a good kind of segment of Match of the Day just showing how disjointed Villa looked, and it looked very un-Emery. Like, he's a guy who pays attention to, like, all the tiny details, and Villa were just all over the shop and didn't really know what hit them. And yeah, Villa were worthy, Newcastle were worthy 5-1 winners in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Sheila, I forgot to ask you, sorry, quickly, Brentford and Spurs predictions.
So who have I got so far? City, Arsenal, United, Liverpool, Newcastle. Did I go Chelsea 6th?
Yeah, you did, yeah.
Yeah, see, Spurs finishing 7th and Brentford 10th.
Sound Newcastle, Villa then. Sheila, a lot of people, some people were touting Villa for sort of top four, certainly top six, but maybe just a wee bit of a reality check for them, although, you know, I'm sure Emery will see to a lot of the issues.
Oh yeah. I think, like, again, to lose your sort of captain, or no, he's not the captain, McGinn's still the captain, but nevertheless, one of your leaders in the team to a bad injury, again, it's always the non-contact ones that are the worst, would have definitely sort of changed the strategy quite dramatically. So it would have taken time to sort that out, maybe even, you know, another week in the training ground, not the next sort of 10-15 minutes within the game. But Newcastle are the ultimate vibes team at the moment, like, especially at home, first game in the season, Champions League football to look forward to. Just really, if you're Villa, who and Emery, who like can make the game a tight, sticky affair, that's just not the kind of team you want to play first game of the season. So I think just Newcastle caught Villa at the right time. And I'm just going to stop slagging Eddie Howe and Sandro Tonali, because every time I slag Newcastle, they fucking do something amazing. But I think it's a question of whether have they really been tested in the sense that, like, you know, you are a Champions League side now. When's that sort of the reality going to hit and get kind of caught out? I think it'll happen eventually. But it's just...
We keep saying that. They're going to end up winning Champions League.
They probably will end up in the Champions League well ahead of schedule.
They've got Man City this weekend.
Away as well. Away title decider. Well. But again, if you're Newcastle, I'd rather get that game out of the way nice and early rather than sort of October, September time. Sort of September.
And City tend to be more fallible this time of the season. You see that year after year. They only ever drop points until December and then they win 25 games in a row.
They're playing in Greece tomorrow in the swelling heat against Seville in the Super Cup as well. So nice time to get them, especially when they've just lost De Bruyne.
So it'd be interesting to see what squad Pep plays for that, given how thin their team looks at the moment.
Sevilla shouldn't be much of a match to them, to be fair.
Hopefully rests Haaland. That's all I really care about, to be honest. Keep him wrapped up in cotton wool.
But it's just Newcastle are just riding the crest of a wave just now. I think that it won't be the only team they cuff 5-1 at home.
I think
duration of the season, but probably aside from Brentford, I'd say they're probably the hardest away game in the league by now.
But other than Man City,
obviously that goes without saying. But I'd sooner play Man City away than I would play Brentford away. Just because you might win against Brentford, but it's going to be a fucking tough game.
Whereas you get City,
you get cuffed 6-0, but your legs won't feel it as much as you'll feel. Like,
you'll be in the pub 2 minutes after full time.
Brentford's a tough game physically, whereas City's just a tough game because you've got no chance of winning, more or less. But
moving on, just to sort of wrap up the rest, Brighton 4, Luton 1. Rob Edwards lost his voice after this one, Mike. I don't know why he was shouting so much. His team never really looked in it.
No, I think Luton are preparing to go down. They've not really recruited for a Premier League kind of season. They've recruited for let's have another crack at the Championship and then we'll have a better go of it next time if we get back up. But again, like the Brighton first game this season, that's no one you want, is it? Especially with deserving his nippy wee tactics. So I think the Luton are going to struggle big time, and I think that bore out in the result of the game as well.
Everton 0, Fulham 1. Sheila, the big talking point was Tarkovsky's GBH on Leno that led to the disallowed Everton goal. How did you see that one?
Well, I haven't seen any highlights of this game, so I haven't seen it at all.
Mike?
No, I didn't fancy watching anything of the Everton Fulham game. I didn't think it was going to be much to talk about.
And you can't blame him for that either. I think Leno, that's a regulation catch, and Tarkovsky's stood in an awkward position beneath him. But he's done fuck all to really impede the goalkeeper, and he's dropped a clanger there and he's got away with one, and it goes into the goalkeeper's protection. I don't quite understand the reason why they're allowed to make mistakes and not be punished for it.
Yeah, he got away with murder there, you think. I don't think that'll go down as a refereeing mistake. I think there's enough sort of
mitigation.
Yeah, I think it's sort of within the range of reasonable decisions that it's just a foul and you just about see why kind of Tarkovsky being in the way that he was, but yeah, certainly from a general perspective got away with one. And they broke the record on Saturday for the highest XG in the Premier League without scoring, which I'm fairly sure Wolves then broke again yesterday, which is quite mad, but they just can't hit a barn door with a banjo, and having Neil Mopai up front is not the solution to that whatsoever. Absolutely fucking delighted to see Sheffield United get beat 0-1 to Palace. Mike, my old man texted me in the week and said, what have you all got against Paul Heckenbottom? So I thought I'd pose the question to you. What does anybody have against Paul Heckenbottom?
That's just the guys are more so than anything. Came up the road, thought he was better than the rest of us, and managed a Hibs team shabbily into the bottom half of the top flight. And I think he's very fortunate to be in a Premier League job. He's done well in the Championship, of course, with Sheffield United, allowing them to bounce back. But I think sooner rather than later, Heckenbottom will get found out to be the geyser that he is.
Yeah, and he's a knob. Let's also add that in as well.
I don't know the man personally, but I don't disagree with that opinion.
He's a fucking wank. Lost 1-0 to Palace. Max Lowe picking a fight with Roy Hodgson and nearly finding out the hard way that Roy still got a temper at the grand old age of 76.
Let's not take a piss, eh?
I love Roy saying as well that he was trying to control the ball and then Max Lowe gave him a wee dig in the ribs. So I was just like, fucking hell, bit much, Max. And then,
do you think if Roy was 20 years younger, it'd say like he was an Alan Pardew type, do you think Max Lowe would have went for him a wee bit more rather than like, oh Christ.
Who was the Norwich player that it was the boy on loan from Man United? Mindy binned Christian Eriksen and went to get up to fucking give him one. Seen it was Eriksen and just gave him a hug instead. Like it was a bit like that. Like Max Lowe's going in, instant reactions like fucking had that in the wee ribs and he's going, shit, I'm just punching on an old man.
I reckon he was just reaching to see if Roy Hodgson had a Withers original in his podcast.
It also, like, it could have ended up being like an Eden Hazard kicking the ball boy situation if he had taken it any further. But yeah, I've also seen a referee Twitter page saying something like, I can't believe we're condoning unacceptable behaviour on the touchline. You're like, fuck off, man. Like, picking a losing battle there. I'd happily see Roy Hodgson give it to young whippersnappers every weekend. I think that'd be fucking class.
There's barely anything in it.
As much as anything, I'm fairly sure Roy Hodgson grabs his arm so he doesn't fall over as much as he's grabbing it out of anger. Arsenal 2, Forest 1. Positives, Mike. Arsenal, 2 good goals. Nketiah filling in for the injured Jesus. Saka still looks brilliant. Martinelli looked good. Negatives, it's just, yeah, another game without a clean sheet that seemed, and I know we're carrying this on from last season, but that was ultimately Arsenal's downfall last season. They conceded so many goals. And you just think, it would have been really nice for them to have started the season with a sort of nice, comfortable, clean sheet, particularly against a team that a lot of people are tipping to go down.
Yeah, I just don't think Ramsdale's that expert a shot stopper either. I think he was responsible for a lot of the porousness at the back end of last season. I don't think, he's improved in my estimations from when we've signed him, but I don't think throughout the course, if you want to be a Champions League title winning team, that he's going to be your number one, but I think David Rea possibly will be. So I think that'll be an upgrade in the position. I think Arteta's been pretty ruthless in that aspect of being in the number one pretty quickly, even if they came with a decent price tag. He did it with Leno in first place with Ramsdale, and now we're just seeing it kind of at a more higher monetary level with Rea and Ramsdale in the end, because I don't think Ramsdale is a bad keeper by any means, but I think he'd be more suited at a West Ham was going quite well. If they were firing where they were a few seasons ago, kind of battling out for European places, I think he'd be an excellent goalkeeper for them, but not for one in the top four.
Yeah, it's a bit bad timing as well, because he did that really nice interview where he spoke about sort of his own mental health and the issues his brother has faced since coming out, and in particular, telling the story that he was absolutely over the moon that his signing to Arsenal had happened and it was the best day of his career and his life. And then he looked at his phone and he had 100 notifications on his phone from folk telling him he was shite and wished he hadn't signed for Arsenal, and thinking that's just social media. So he turned his social media off, stuck on Sky Sports News, and it was all his favourite footballers from growing up sitting on a panel on Sky Sports News saying he was shite and he wasn't worth the money, which you can kind of laugh at, but if genuinely you put yourself in his shoes, like, arguably the most exciting day of your career, and you put the telly on and there's all your heroes saying that you were shite. It'd be pretty disappointing. But you know, he's clearly got the mental resolution to have got through it, and the confidence, and keepers are always a bit mad. But yeah, I think if I had signed for Chelsea and I put the telly on and John Terry was sat there saying that Jamie Guyon's fucking pitch, man, I'd be absolutely gutted. But yeah, bad timing, because he did that interview and now he's away to be buying off by Arsenal. And probably going to have to find himself a new job in January, if not next summer. And the last game, Burnley 0, Manchester City 3. Sheila, the routiniest of routine wins, really, for Man City. Vincent Kompany said we'll not play that bad again all season. So certainly got high hopes for his team. But sort of one of those games where absolutely no talking points come out of it whatsoever.
No, City do what City do. But to be honest, I was delighted to see them win comfortably, because I was a wee bit offended, if I'm being honest, Jamie, and I'll tell you why. Because of the absolute mutual wankfest all over Sky Sports that, like, Vincent Kompany had Burnley playing good football as if Sean Dyche didn't take them to Europe. You know what I mean? Like, I just thought it was quite disrespectful. Not intentionally, but, like, just, like, pied off Sean Dyche's achievements as if they were, you know, nothing. Like, he did keep Burnley in the Premier League for a number of years, and as I say, got them to Europe. And what was it? He finished
seventh.
So, which is mental for Burnley. If Kompany, as good as a player as he was, has achieved, you know, a fraction of what Sean Dyche has achieved in the game. So I didn't really appreciate the just because it's Vincent Kompany, it's a kind of more
mad
fashionable manager, if you like, than.
Literally and metaphorically.
Yeah.
But you make a good point. We discussed this last year that, like, you know, Sam Allardyce obviously brings it up. If he was called Sam Allardyce, he would have been at the top of the game. But there is definitely something to be said for certain managers not getting the credit they deserve because they're not the sexy picks, so to speak. And sort of Vincent Kompany is a very stylish guy and he speaks very well and has the Man City aura behind him as well. And you're right, you know, he seems to have an awful, awful lot of credit in the bank straight away.
That's true. And again, it's kind of nice to see, like, teams go out and play good football, but I'm pretty sure Tony Mowbray tried that with West Brom, and it all went horribly wrong.
Daniel Fark tried it two, three times in a row in Norwich.
And it all went horribly wrong. So, you know,
equally, it's nice to see a top-level footballer take on a championship job. And I know some people will say that's still a leapfrog, but it's...
Was he not in Belgium before that?
Yeah. Oh, of course he was. Yeah, of course he was. Sorry.
The top job in Belgium. Burnley's by no means a gimme, but, you know, they're still one of the yo-yo teams, so it's hardly like, you know, he's taken Luton up like someone else has. So, do you know what I mean? So it's not
Nathan Jones anyway.
Not Nathan Jones. Has he gone anywhere yet?
Oh no, he's still back.
That's such a shame that the poor boy's ruined his career after 9 games in the Premier League.
But I was rather offended by that on behalf of Sean Dyche. So if Sean Dyche hears this, you know, I've got your back, don't worry about it.
We'll clip it and send it to him, make him feel better.
But other than that, like, I was quite chuffed to see them get cuffed 3-0.
And a double for Haaland, so same old story with him.
Yeah, it was a spirited performance, but I think if you concede that early against City, then it's extremely difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, that's kind of what they want, is for you to come at them and try and force it. And obviously you leave yourself more exposed. So yeah, it was a difficult one. And I think that's sort of the byproduct of trying to play attractive football, is you do need to have a kind of a plan B and try and keep it tight and try and nick a goal back, which we'll see if Burnley do have that in their locker, whereas if they go behind, can they, you know, stay in the game? And in this instance, no, they didn't really get close. I don't remember having, you know, like Ederson's, for Ederson to keep a clean sheet, like as me and Michael attest, they've had him in our fantasy teams for most of the last year, that, you know, they're pretty rare occurrence over the past year or so. So if he can get a shot on goal, there is a good chance he's going to drop it in the net. But Burnley didn't even achieve that. So yeah, work to be done.
Absolutely. And I think that probably does it for the Premier League, unless I've missed any talking points either of you wanted to jump on.
Just a minor one about Burnley, obviously. Weghorst leaving these shores for good.
Oh, yeah. Back to, was it Hoffenheim?
Aye, the massive loving we had when they came in at Burnley in the first instance, thinking he was going to fire them to safety. Did he get one goal maybe or something like
two,
that?
Two, I think, overall. But yeah, it wasn't great.
And
like,
then we went to Man United, who thought, oh, he might be the missing link that they need to kind of get him firing. No, sadly, Vout wasn't. That'll go in the World Cup against Argentina. That'll live on forever in the memory of this podcast, of course.
Absolutely, yeah. That was the January transfer window of our first season, when we had touted Chris Wood to be the most underrated striker in the Premier League, and he got his big money move to Newcastle. Which then didn't work out. And then we still managed to say that Weghorst coming in at Burnley, that Burnley had done great business with a massive improvement, getting rid of Chris Wood and bringing in this proven, unbelievable goal scorer. And that didn't work out either. So good to see the analysis hasn't got any worse over the last 2.5 seasons since then. A blast from the past. Quick touch on Scottish football. Aberdeen's match day 2. 1-3 defeat to Celtic, following on from a 1-1 draw away at Livingston the weekend prior. Doesn't look like the best start. 1 point from an available 6 in the first 2 games going into the Cup this weekend. But actually, we're net 1 point up on the corresponding 2 fixtures from last season. So there's a positive to look at. We lost both those games. Thought we looked really good against Celtic. Played some decent football, got in their faces. Looked well organised. JJ Bull's been waxing lyrical on Twitter about our pressing and counter-pressing, that, you know, it's just something you haven't seen from an Aberdeen side ever, because we've just never really had the calibre of coaches to be able to do it. So it's a huge compliment to Barry Robson and Steve Agnew that they seem to have the team operating at that kind of level. Equally, we conceded 2 absolutely appalling goals, in particular Nicky Devlin heading it directly to Kyogo to slot home for the second, which is a bit of a sore one when you've got yourself back into the game, particularly against Celtic. And while you never expect to get anything out of these games, equally, when they have an off day, you've sort of got to take your opportunity when it presents itself. And it seemed like it did here. So bittersweet in terms of performance and result. Stirling Albion on Friday night in the Cup, which we've sold our allocation for, and hopefully we'll see us through to the quarter. Is this the one before the quarterfinal, or is this the quarterfinal?
No, this is the last 16.
16, yeah.
You played them last season, did you not? In the group stage, you still are, I mean. They're going right under the Darren Young or Derek Hill.
Derek's at Aberdeen.
There you go. They're 2 wins from 2 in League One. Obviously came up through the playoffs in League Two last season. I'm not saying it shouldn't be one you don't win comfortably, but
I don't think we can bank ourselves on any cup games at the moment.
They might give you a game. It shouldn't be a darvel, but they should still give you a game.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Elsewhere, Dunfermline, good opening day victory against the Adrianians, team that they came up with, and then sort of second and 94th minute equaliser conceded against Dundee United at the weekend. Positives, a bittersweet again, I suppose. Mike, positive way to start the season, 4 points from 6, including against Dundee United. But when you're in that position against Dundee United, a killer to lose it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was basically the last kick of the ball as well. And to be fair, that Matthew Cujo looks a player. And considering what they did the weekend before against Arbroath on the telly, of course, you kind of feared the worst going up to Tannadice. Maybe you're thinking Dundee United kind of hit their stride, but yes, of course you would take the point, but in circumstances like that, yeah, it's sickening. The fact we've got 2 weeks now to the Rafe game to dwell on it, and now it's not the best, but in a way it's not the worst timing in the world, because perhaps some of the boys are going to come back from injury. that can only be a positive for the Preston squad.
Sheila, how have you found the opening couple of games being back in the Championship?
I think both results are positive. I hope the team don't dwell on Dundee United one too much, because obviously Mike will tell you that when we played Dundee United in the Championship and the most recent times we faced them, they're a bogey team. We can't seem to find a way to beat them. And to be one kick away, I suppose, from doing that, I can take some positives from that. And I think the 3 points against Airdrie will prove to be a crucial three later on in the season. If we've, again, I'd just be quite happy if we solidify ourselves in the Championship and can build on it next year. Anything above that's a bonus, just for the sort of the lack of business that's been done. It's just a case of, we'll sign boys that we know. Ken Richie Holser, Sam Fisher fall into that category. We know what they can do, and they're going to be good players for us, but it's just a case of, where are the goals coming from, really? That's the thing. I don't see us getting turned over very often this season. I just think a lot of games are going to be very tight affairs, so it might make a kind of boring watch for most Dunfermline supporters. But no, 4 points from the opening six against the Adrianians and Dundee United, I can't say I'm disappointed with that. Very, very good start.
Fantastic. Well, it's an absolute pleasure to have been back, gents. A thorough review of all the talking points from the weekend. We go again, as I've said, cup football north of the border for most teams. Another exciting week in the Premier League, and that Man City Newcastle game probably stands out as the one to look out for this weekend. Sheila, we didn't quite cover off all your predictions, but we've got your top seven down to Spurs, and then you had Brentford in 10th. Who were your three to go down?
In 10th, so three to go down are Sheffield United, Luton, and Wolves.
Which is, I think, what 6 out of 7 of our predictors have gone for. One other going for, I think it was Kieran, went for West Ham instead of Wolves.
Bold.
Yeah, well, he went Leicester last season and we all laughed at him, and look how that turned out. So he wants another scalp, and he's coming for David Moyes this year with the Kieran curse. It's been fantastic, gents. An absolute pleasure. Thank you both for your time and for jumping on, and I look forward to speaking to you again next week.